hopefully won't be here too long, and there's no more public testimony. So with that, questions, Representative Gray.
Testing, testing. Are we wired for sound here?
Charger up, Scotty.
All right, good. That's good. All the things I said are not on the record. That's good to know. Mr. Chairman, first of all, might I inquire as to how the list of testifiers was put together? And the reason I ask that is I know in some of our previous hearings, you know, there were members from African-American community in particular, and I'm sure the Southeast Asian community as well, who were not advocates of combining Minneapolis and St. Paul and probably would have had some concerns about this map. And I'm wondering, were they contacted, or how did we go about notifying those folks who might have been available to testify as to the map and the fact that we were taking testimony today?
Well, Representative Gray, I mean, the notice was put out on Monday. We're having the committee hearing today. I think the redistricting analyst, Greg Pepin, contacted many first-ring suburban communities based on a Star Tribune article that was in the paper about getting input from first-ring suburban communities. So those contacts were made, and lists kind of developed from then, as well as from some previous witnesses that I think had seen that we were having the hearing that came forward. I know you were offered, I think, two or three, maybe four times, just to see if you had anyone to come in. You said you couldn't think of anybody. You said you might have some written testimony.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to, I guess, refresh your memory on that. I did indicate that we would be trying to obtain certain written testimony from Minneapolis Urban League, Minneapolis NAACP, other groups that had testified in the past. Certainly due to the timing of this and the relatively short notice, it's difficult to get folks out on a weekday at 8 o'clock when their schedules are already filled, especially folks who work for nonprofits and probably have other responsibilities as well. So, I just wanted to make it clear, I guess, on the record that there are others out there. I know we have resolutions from Ramsey County, I believe, and City of St. Paul. I know Minneapolis is going to weigh in on this issue as well, who are not supportive of this plan, and we need to make sure that their information is on the record. And I have your understanding, at least I have the understanding from you, that any written testimony that is received will be added to the record. Is that correct?
Is that the proper procedure, Mr. Pender, in terms of, do you know how is written testimony submitted for the record?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gray, normally the record, if we'd call it that, is the minutes of a committee meeting plus anything that's handed out during the meeting, and of course the tape of the meeting. So I guess I've never had the issue raised before of supplementing the records of the meeting with written material turned in afterwards. So I guess I don't know the answer to that question, but I would think maybe that if the chair would agree that written testimony would be received and handed out at a, you know, and put in the members' packets at the next meeting if there is one, that would be one way of
Mr.
handling
Chairman.
It. So they'd be in the, you know, they'd be treated more like things are usually treated.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Gray, and if you have testimony, I mean, written testimony, you said you'd bring that today.
Yes.
If you could leave that.
And I did just want to indicate that I had informed the chair in advance that it was likely or at least possible that we would be trying to add written testimony. So, I mean, this is not something I'm coming up with right now. It's something that I had indicated. And you are all probably far more familiar with parliamentary procedure and Masons and all those other good things that we utilize. I certainly don't know of any reason why the oral testimony of a committee cannot be supplemented with written documentation, and I would be surprised if that's not something that had been done in the past. But again, that's something that you can determine, Mr. Chairman. I would certainly strongly advocate that we supplement this record because I think it's incomplete. But I'll wait for your ruling on that after you've had a chance.
Okay, I don't think there's anything for me to rule on other than to say, I mean, if you have handouts, that would be...
Then they will be added to the record.
That would be added, yeah.
Thank you.
As well as I understand now, the Senate is probably going to have a hearing on this bill next week. And so there'll be opportunity for these groups to come forward as well next week, I believe.
Fantastic. Mr. Chairman, I do have a question. I know Representative Mariani probably has questions as well. With regard to the map, I know the senator, when he was here, had talked about it complying with all the various principles, the majority and the minority, both in the House and in the Senate, as well as, I thought he said, as well as the governor, the principles that had been agreed to by that task force. One of those principles included competitive districts, at least the governor's, and I believe the Senate's might as well. Has that been factored into this plan, and if so, in what way, and how have you gone about determining whether or not there is some competitive districts in this?
Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Gray, this was more of a work of Senator Kleiss's, but in looking at this map, competitiveness was probably factored in the fact that right now the 4th and 5th congressional districts neither are competitive, and right now you have, if you want to characterize the new 5th district as non-competitive, I suppose you could. I would characterize the 4th and 5th districts currently as non-competitive. Quite frankly, speaking from a perspective as a Republican, all 8 of these congressional districts could be held by DFLers, quite honestly. And if you take a look at the 2nd district, which is chiefly the same as it was before, was held for the last 8 years by a DFLer, Mr. Mingy. The 7th is held, the 7th has changed marginally, but not enormously. And Congressman Peterson has won by wide margins the last 3 election cycles. Congressman Oberstar in the 8th district would be a likely winner. The 5th district, Congressman Sabo, would be probably a likely winner. Assuming Congressman Luther moves back home to the 6th district, would be a likely winner. Congresswoman McCollum, being born in South St. Paul and raised there from North St. Paul, as a suburban woman, as she always characterizes herself, could win the 4th district. The 3rd district now includes a big portion of inner ring suburbs and portion of Minneapolis, minus Congressman Ramstead would probably be in jeopardy. And Congressman Gutnick has never won by a large margin. And if he leaves, I think the 1st district, as it proved, largely the way it is the last 8 years, it's the same way now, except for a few changes here and there. That seat could potentially be in jeopardy, as Congressman Penny proved in the 80s, winning by over 70% many times. So, you know, it might be actually non-competitive for Republicans, if you want to characterize it that way. When I look at this, and I agreed to carry this as a companion for Senator Kleiss, competitiveness was probably factored in, but I think you take a look at that North Suburban District, you've got area that Governor Ventura ran in very well. What the chief concern was that I was concerned about in listening to testimony was communities of interest, keeping those united, keeping the 4 rural, chiefly rural, 4 non-rural districts was some testimony I had heard as a rural member. I'm very concerned about that. In uniting communities of interest that we heard this morning, the suburban folks wanting to be kept with suburban folks, the urban interests being served, the dominant interests in the core cities of urban development, housing, transportation, immigration, those challenging issues that they need a congressman dedicated full time to those issues. where they're not half and half, where they're maybe worried about green space in the suburbs, they're worried about a different type of child care, a different type of job growth issue, a different type of rapid growth housing issue, where we have dense urban stock in the new 5th District, they can have a congressman fighting for them full time. So I guess I was more concerned about the principles of keeping communities of interest united, keeping the testimony in mind of the 4 rural, 4 non-rural districts. Competitiveness was probably factored into a slight extent, but I think, quite honestly, we have a more competitive map than we did before, because I don't think the 4th and 5th District are competitive at all. So if anything, we have one more competitive district, and one under this map, we have a more competitive district added to the ledger than before.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gray.
Representative, I guess I would certainly argue that, you know, the new 5th District is I wouldn't go so far as to say packing, but is far less competitive than it might otherwise be, and that it's likely that the 4th District, and I haven't seen the numbers, I haven't had the benefit of those numbers in terms of the indexes, but that might be significantly less competitive for DFLers. Although, I think the 5th is probably significantly less competitive for Republicans. Beyond that, though, I guess in terms of the communities of interest that you've talked about, I have some significant concerns with how we go about defining what those communities of interest are. In particular, with regard to Minneapolis, certainly my district is adjacent to Golden Valley. There's certainly significant similarities in, say, Brooklyn Center and even Robbinsdale that might match with Minneapolis and have traditionally been more satellites even of Minneapolis as inner-ring suburbs than St. Paul. And I guess I'm kind of interested in how you went about with determining these communities of interest, especially given the historic competitive aspect between Minneapolis and St. Paul. And that goes across the board in terms of communities of color as well as the majority communities. We've for a long time had a St. Paul paper, a Minneapolis paper. You look in the black press, there was the Minneapolis spokesman, the St. Paul Recorder. You look at, in terms of organizations, there's a Minneapolis Urban League, a St. Paul Urban League. There's a Minneapolis NAACP, St. Paul NAACP. Significant cultural differences and cultural ideologies between the two cities. I would argue strongly that there are in many ways more similarities between Minneapolis and some of its neighboring first-ring suburbs in terms of issues like affordable housing, like the influx of immigrant communities, which are extensive in Brooklyn Center, as I said, and Golden Valley, and even St. Louis Park, than there are between Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, In a follow-up to the first question that was asked, I think we drew lines not for politicians and politics, but rather for communities of interest. And not saying Congressman so-and-so deserves this district or party so-and-so deserves this district, but what communities of interest we have. That's a good line in to the next line of questioning and how these lines were determined. I'm not sure Golden Valley even has an NAACP, and so I'd submit you just gave me a whole list of reasons why Minneapolis and St. Paul are probably together, and that is because they do have those commonality of interests, and I think immigration to St. Paul is probably more heavy than it is in the Golden Valley. I know Brooklyn Center has had quite a few immigration issues pop up, probably Crystal and Robbinsdale, but probably not as heavy as the St. Paul area. And if you look at the communities of interest that we talked about this morning, when we had the mayors and the city councilmen come in, they gave a lot of reasons. The Suburban Mayors Association, Suburban Chamber of Commerce, whether it's Twin West or otherwise, transportation, watersheds, school districts, Minneapolis has its own school district. St. Paul has its own school district. Now, there are isolated examples of where there has been some cooperation, but when you look at the chief commonalities, it is very difficult to argue that the commonalities with Minneapolis, Golden Valley, Plymouth are very similar as opposed to Minneapolis and St. Paul. And you look under the current map, when you've got Edina with North Minneapolis, it just doesn't make sense to me that we would argue that North Minneapolis has more in common with Edina than it does with the Frogtown neighborhood of St. Paul. It defies common sense. Do you have to cross a river? Sure. But in many cases, you see us crossing rivers under both the current plan and under this proposed plan that have to take place regardless. I think the commonalities by far outweigh the differences when you look at the Minneapolis-St. Paul lineups. The suburban folks that we heard of, whether they were from Eagan or whether they were from Maplewood, whether they were from New Hope this morning or Columbia Heights, I think really etched out a very concrete proposal of commonalities and why they would like to have a fourth district configured the way it is with Washington, suburban Ramsey, and northern Dakota counties having a lot of commonalities, whether it be school districts, local units of government, etc. combined. And having the suburban Ramsey-Anoka district and the 6th district combined, where there's a lot of commonality interests in that particular area. Change is hard, but I think the change to having Minneapolis and St. Paul combined really follows through with common sense and commonalities. Representative Gray basically gave us a list of why there are commonalities, whether it be NAACP chapters, Urban League chapters, or whatever. The commonalities follow through quite a bit. No one's going to dispute that the current 4th and 5th districts, and the current map is obsolete, by the way. I think we all need to admit that. We all talk about, well, the 4th district now has this type of population, the 5th district has this one. That's irrelevant because it's an obsolete map. The map is obsolete. We are not at a zero population deviation right now under our map. So we can't really... in good faith, reference the current map and say, well, this map has such and such percentage. It's an obsolete map. It's time to change again. This is the only proposal that we've had before us since April 23rd of the year 2001. I would like to debate another plan and say this map right here, C0001-1, is much better than map C0002. Unfortunately, we can't do that because there is no alternative. Whether it's from another Republican member of this body, whether it's from the DFL minority in the House or the majority in the Senate, we had it outlined this morning that we have very limited time left in this session. This plan has been on the table for people to scrutinize, to do number runs on, whether you want to talk about competitiveness, whether you want to talk about racial and ethnic minorities, enhancements, etc. We don't have another plan. You can't bring out the map that we have currently and say, we want to talk about this because it's an obsolete map. Everyone's going to admit that if you keep the core cities separate, they are going to have to go further and further and further into the second and third tier suburbs. I don't think that those communities of interest are going to be served if you have that split of those urban centers that have so much in common, that have so many interests, that need one congressman fighting for their interests and not to be conflicted and say, well, Frogtown needs this, but I'm not real sure that Eagan or Rosemount would like this. Under this map, they're not going to have those conflicts within their own district. They're going to be able to fight for the needs of that particular district because the communities of interest will be united. As long as I'm on the subject of the numbers, Mr. Chairman, we had some numbers that were brought forward. Representative Mariani mentioned the new 5th district is 8.19% Hispanic, 7.07% voting age Hispanic. The current 4th district is 5.36% total Hispanic, 4.39% voting age Hispanic. Current 5th district is 6.23% total Hispanic, 5.39% voting age Hispanic. So clearly, we are enhancing the abilities of minorities not only to have a say in who their congressman is, but to have a monumental chance of perhaps getting elected. not only Hispanics but also the African American community to have a big say in having a big influence and a voice. You know, I could put a plug in for Representative Gray as the next congressman for the 5th District, or Representative Mariani, quite frankly, and they would make good congressmen.
All in favor?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
But I think in a diluted situation where you're throwing in the Edinas, the Minnetonkas of the world, we are going to the world of too much delusion and not enough enhancement.
Not Mr. enough Chairman. Enhancement.
Representative Gray.
Well, thank you for your vote.
I have relatives up here.
With regard, first of all, you know, you talked about NAACP and no chapter in Golden Valley. Well, first of all, most of those suburban areas around Minneapolis, those members are members of the Minneapolis NAACP, so there is that commonality there. Secondly, with regard to, you know, the fact that a congressperson who would represent, say, just Minneapolis, or Minneapolis and St. Paul, that somehow those interests are not diverse or not as diverse as representing Minneapolis and suburban areas, I think that's totally false. I mean, if you look at homeowners around the lakes or homeowners along the river, very high income folks, even one of your folks who testified indicated that many of those folks around the lake, in terms of Lake Harriet and that area, Lake Calhoun, had common interests with folks in Edina and elsewhere. Well, we have many places in Minneapolis. We have extremely high rent, high property value areas. We have folks that aren't doing nearly as well. We have immigrant communities. We have very established neighborhoods. To suggest that somehow just because you represent Minneapolis and St. Paul, you won't have the same kind of competing interests, I think is false. I think that any congressperson who represents that area is going to have to look at the overall good of the entire region and make tough decisions, whether those include suburban neighborhoods or not. And then I guess finally, you know, this idea that by raising the minority percentage, say, from 5% to 7% is going to give a community a substantially greater say in the election of the next person to Congress, I think, again, is false. I think it we already in Minneapolis, certainly the African-American community, and I think other communities feel that they have substantial significant say as they stand now, and to combine and gain, say, 2%, I think is less important than having a say and having some influence in two congressional seats as opposed to one. At that, I know my colleague has questions, so I will stop at that point. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Real quickly,
my senior colleague.
Real quickly, Representative Sager.
Mr. Chair, just in response, that was the percentage I gave. It was only Hispanic. The minority population, I believe, is around 38%, if I'm not mistaken, and that is a substantial enhancement. As I mentioned earlier this morning, and you hesitated to use the word packing as well, we could have dropped out the Highland Park neighborhood of St. Paul and moved into Brooklyn Center if we really want to do the traditional quote-unquote packing argument. But I think the substantial enhancement, when you look at 38% and the influence within the DFL party, because there's a mechanism of getting elected that's, a lot of us think general election. But when you look at the mechanism of in Minnesota, and we have a very unique process of electing congressmen in Minnesota, which is usually endorsement, nomination, election. In a district like this, more often than not, winning the endorsement means winning the primary. And when I served in the legislature like you did with Betty McCollum, the day after she won the endorsement, I said, congratulations, Congresswoman. And you can we'd set it in the back elevator here. Endorsement usually means nomination. Nomination usually means winning the general in these particular districts, whether it's 4 or 5 currently. So I think enhancing without packing is one of the best things that we can do to ensure that voice of a fighting spirit for those communities. And with that, I know Representative Mary.
One final comment, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I think certainly folks like Skip Humphrey would disagree with you about election or endorsement, meaning election, and even Norm Coleman would probably disagree with you on that.
That's statewide, though.
Well, in any case, the two don't necessarily correlate. Beyond that, though, this whole issue that, you know, you talk about 38% minority, as though minorities vote as a block or somehow would support the same candidate or have the same views, I think reflects some misunderstanding of those communities. I mean, the fact that we brought each one of those communities in as a separate entity, the Asian community, the Hispanic community, African-American community, and we could talk about other immigrant communities, the Somalis and many others, who would comprise that 38%, all of whom have extremely different attitudes and different needs. I mean, an immigrant community like certainly the Somalis and the Southeast Asian community have very, very different perceptions and different needs than an African American community that has been established in Minneapolis and St. Paul for a significant period of time. So I think it certainly is a bad idea for us to get the attitude that minorities in some way think alike or act alike or alike and would vote alike. I think we could look at that and find that there's substantial differences.
Sure. And Representative Mariani proved that this morning when, was it Mr. Aguilar was here? You've obviously have a little history there.
Well, Representative Gray, there are changes that are occurring now with the Supreme Court cases, obviously, and with the North Carolina case, I think they did show, you know, that when minorities are voting as a block, there can be changes, dilutions there.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I would agree if they vote as a block. I would just suggest that certainly when you look at the demographics more closely, frankly, African-Americans between Minneapolis and St. Paul, if there was a candidate for endorsement from St. Paul who was African-American versus a candidate from Minneapolis who was African-American, there would be substantial conflict in rallying around one or the other. Both of those groups would tend to support the folks in their particular area. And we had testimony from St. Paul NAACP when she talked about the separate communities, talked about the Rondo community in St. Paul versus, say, North Minneapolis, where there's substantial conflicts that have existed over a period of time. So, again, I'm not suggesting that you know, it's totally impossible, but I am suggesting that that is not the attitude that we should have, that somehow putting all minorities into one district or a substantial number is going to lead to a minority candidate.
Right. Representative Saber, correct me if I'm wrong, but this doesn't bring in minorities all the way up into Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We stop at the line, you know, as I said earlier, if you were looking at some type of packing argument, you'd take Highland Park out, you'd move into Brooklyn Center. But to say that we're not enhancing opportunity in this map, I don't understand it. If we'd have half the population and spread out to Golden Valley, Plymouth, and Maple Grove and say this is helping minorities by expanding the lines out to Maple Grove and Minnetonka, I don't get it, but... to me, it's just a common sense argument. And maybe we just have to agree to disagree on that point, let someone else figure it out.
But, Mr. Chairman, you're probably absolutely right. And I guess I one thing for future reference, if you're around 10 years from now, I know I won't be, it would be nice to actually do the map or have a general idea of the map and let those communities that come testify make some comments about the map. And... the big flaw, I think, in this whole process is that we asked a lot of nebulous questions about, you know, where do you go eat and, you know, do you cross the bridge and that kind of stuff, instead of being able to actually show them a general example of this is what we're planning on doing. What do you think? And I think we would have gotten some testimony, a lot of testimony on the record from communities of color that, no, we don't like that idea.
Representative Gray, just to follow up on what I mentioned earlier, apparently from the three-judge panel in the New Jersey case that was just discussed recently, It says in here that, you know, testimony about crossover support by both Hispanic and African-American legislators strongly suggests, and we so find, that the African-American and Hispanic communities often vote as a block, a fact which may be considered in assessing the ability of either community to elect a candidate of its choice. So it certainly is a factor.
I hate having to talk all this much. I would, again, argue that, you know, when you start at factoring in the other communities as well, I mean, we're talking about a diverse minority community in the Twin Cities area, not just Latinos or Hispanics and African Americans, but a rising immigrant population of Asians and Somalis and other Africans, you know, and then even within the Latino community, you know, you've got Mexicans and you've got Puerto Ricans and you've got many others. I mean, Minnesota, I think, has not had enough experience with diversity to even have an ideal of how those communities are going to work and vote. And to suggest that putting them all together somehow gets you closer to minority representation, I think, again, is just a misunderstanding of those communities.
Go ahead. Representative Mariani.
I'll let my friend from St. Paul.
Yeah, Representative Mariani.
I don't have any response.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm quickly trying to read that case. This is evidently a pretty new case that came out of New Jersey, but as I understood it, the case also says that there's no need to put different minority communities together. In fact, they found that minority community, they rejected the Republican claim that the new map discriminated against minority voters because it broke up three predominantly black districts in and around Newark. So I guess, and we'll look at this more carefully, I suppose, in the coming days, but I think the case is not made in the New Jersey case for us to put three, four different minority communities together in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And in fact, the courts evidently seem to rule in this case that it's okay to keep those communities separate. I would argue that based on the testimony that we've heard, you know, through the last few weeks and even the testimony that we heard today, that much of the case has not been made. I didn't hear any arguments from any of the on the issue of the minority representation and voting. I didn't hear any arguments from any of the communities of color here that would give us any direction on a commonality of voting. We can probably infer some of that. You know, the four people of color in the legislature are DFLers, so you might infer that those communities of color would vote DFL, but there really wasn't any testimony that was offered here by any of the witnesses that would lead a reasonable person to believe that Hispanic person on the west side of St. Paul is going to vote the same way as an African-American in North Minneapolis. I think, you know, in terms of the, you know, and Representative Sever, I think, you know, you make some, you know, some valid arguments here, but I have to say that in answer to the question of, you know, eventual congressional representation, you know, long-term answer to that is it'd be great if Representative Gray and I both served in Congress together, representing both the current, you know, core of the 4th and the 5th district. And I think that's really what's at stake here. You know, when we did our own projections, Mr. Chair, in terms of the growth rates that we're currently seeing in these minority communities, it doesn't take you too many years out there, you know, 5 or 10 years, and you're already bumping up against 35-48% total minority population in the 4th district and over 50% in the 5th district. You know, the long-term impact of combining Minneapolis and St. Paul, I would argue, would be to minimize the impact that minority communities can have on these two separate communities that currently exist in two congressional districts. But I do have a question for Representative Seifert, and hopefully we can get it be out of here soon. As I look at the district that Betty McCollum currently represents, I see a whole lot of it no longer being in what would be the new fourth, and a whole lot of new area now being added to that fourth. Can you tell me how much of that current district that she represents right now, how much of that she loses, and how much, what percentage of new area, assuming that she would run again under this scheme, how much new area would she be adding, would she be running in?
Cyprian, is that a figure you have?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have that in front of me, but I would say that in drawing these maps, rather than following parties and politicians, we followed the principles of redistricting: compactness, zero deviation, reflecting the changes of the last 10 years, which was suburban growth, etc. I don't have that in front of me because I didn't draw a district for quote unquote Betty McCollum or Marty Sable or whoever. What we wanted to do was follow communities of interest, compactness, zero deviation, etc. And in following the principles of redistricting, over who has what and what person or what party gets this or gets that. So if there's concern about what we're doing to serve a person rather than a principal, I can get that information. But I'd rather put the interest of serving the principles of redistricting and the ethics that we've upheld with the zero deviation, the communities of interest, and reflecting the changes of the last 10 years demographically over person X or person Y. But I can certainly get that information for Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Seifert, I would greatly appreciate it, although if you don't have it today, I suppose I can figure this out when we go back to our own GIS. I would just say that, in fact, it looks like the majority of our current district winds up being cut out of the district that would be represented by the area that she currently lives in. And, you know, maybe it was just, you know, kind of blind luck or trial and error that we wind up with a district with a 7% spread between DFLers and Republican indexes as measured by the governor's indexes to one that has a 9% spread in the opposite direction. So in other words, we now would have a fourth district that has a 45% Republican index as opposed to a 36% Democratic index, and that's roughly a 9% difference as opposed to the current 37 Republican to 44 with a 7% index. So this is a pretty dramatic change in the political landscape of Minnesota, and perhaps it's warranted, but I think it needs to be pointed out that in fact it is pretty dramatic. And while it's all good and good to say that, you know, we're not drawing maps for individuals, I would point out that it's probably been, 50 years since we last had a woman representing?
1958, Koya Knudsen.
Yeah, almost 50 years, is that right? Or 40, a little over 40 years, 43 years. 40 years, yeah. Since we had a woman representing Minnesota in our congressional delegation, and we've only had, to my knowledge, one woman other than the incumbent. Am I correct?
Muriel Humphrey was appointed. Mr. Chair, Muriel Humphrey was appointed to the Senate on the passing of her husband. It was an appointed. She wasn't elected. Okay. It would have been the U.S. Senate, but it was technically a member of Congress. But so, you are correct in the Koya Knudsen
so
analogy.
Mr. Mariani.
In our 140-plus history as a state, we've had three women in Congress representing us, and Representative McCollum was just recently elected, and if she would want to continue to honor that Minnesota tradition of that new tradition, hopefully, of having half our population be represented by a woman, she would have to run in a district that is primarily foreign to her, in a brand new district. I would point out also that Representative McCollum is a person of American Indian heritage. I don't know if you knew that. But it's something that she's been particularly proud of, and while not an enrolled member of any tribe, has claimed that, and during her years here at the legislature, has often championed issues from that community. So in terms of some of our concern with minority communities, it seems to me that we're also doing some damage there. So I think, you know, I just want to, you know, for the record, I want to bring this out, Representative Seifert, that this does, in fact, dramatically, I would argue, change the political landscape, certainly in the eastern metropolitan area of the Twin Cities area, but obviously for all of Minnesota, and does so in a way that, at least by the indexes, and you know any good, you know, candidate can always beat an index, but at least by the indexes would give a Republican advantage greater than the Democratic advantage that currently exists in that fourth district.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know that's a terrible thing that we, you know, that our map is supposed to show DFL indexes higher than in most of the cases, but we change it, and Representative Mariani's numbers, we changed by 1% on each side. He said 37R, 44D right now, and it goes to 45-36, so it's a 1% change on each side, which I don't think is a monumental change, but I would argue that this new 4th District, if you take a look at it, and I'd ask the members to pull the map out, treats women of both parties very well. Senator Krenz from May Township, DFL. Senator Weiner, who also represents a Republican-leaning district, who has Egan, Mendota Heights, part of Apple Valley. We also have Senator Bachman. We've had, and Representative Slawick, Senator, and I'm not going to mention, obviously there's men like Senator Metzen and Representative Milbert and Representative Pugh and Representative Wozlik and so forth. But this particular area, when you look at, throw in Senator Bachman and for 6 years Representative Peg Larson, this particular area has treated women quite well. And just because of an RD index, I'm not real sure that that's necessarily going to throw Representative McCollum out of office. Now, I guess this all assumes Representative Luther moves back home and runs in the 6th district where he's from anyway. But, you know, I think when you take a look at the voting history, and I don't like to get into this competitive RD business because we're drawing these for communities of interest, following the principles of redistricting, following the changes of the last 10 years. But if we want to get into that argument, I think the argument can be made that this is competitive, that women of both parties can win in these districts in the legislative level. And I think Representative McCollum, if this plan is adopted, does have a very good chance. But I don't think it's incumbent upon us in the legislature to guarantee that Representative McCollum or any other member of Congress is guaranteed reelection. I don't think that's why we're here. We're not here to serve the interests of the incumbents. We're not here to serve the interests of a party, and we're not here to serve the interests of politicians and political parties. We're here to serve the interests of Minnesota in following the changes of the last 10 years, following the principles of redistricting that we laid out, and that's what this map does. We have seen a suburban influx of people. No one is going to dispute that. This map reflects those changes. Is it competitive for Representative McCollum? Absolutely. But if you look at the legislative races and others, I think you'll find that that this is a competitive district, and we are not unduly burdening her in an uncompetitive district.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mariani, Seifert, I would agree with you that our goal should not be to necessarily protect incumbents, but I would equally agree with you that our goal should not be to unnecessarily hinder our current incumbents. And, you know, the blindness issue needs to work both ways. And this map, in addition to the flip-flopping the percentages, perhaps more importantly, puts an incumbent into a totally brand new area for huge chunks. It looks like almost 80% of her district. And it seems to me that that certainly merits discussion, and I would argue that that probably puts us in the direction of unnecessarily hindering an incumbent, obviously a person who's elected by the people. Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Mariani, I mean, that is obviously not one of the standards that, passed in terms of having to protect an incumbent. In fact, the Senate, I think, would agree from the same standpoint. Well, I mean, a Republican woman could run in the 6th Congressional District as well as a Republican woman in the 4th Congressional District against Representative McCollum.
Mr. Chair, if you remember on the floor of the House, I tried offering that amendment that we, in fact, pay attention to, you know, be very deliberate about not wanting to hurt or help either way. And on a party line vote, that was voted down. So I was trying to bring that issue to the floor, and evidently there's a reason why that was voted down. But Mr. Chair, I'd like to point out for the record my distribution of both the City of St. Paul and the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners resolutions. And these are pretty recent resolutions. And I just want to make sure that they get entered into the record. The City of St. Paul talked about this issue and recognizing St. Paul as the second largest city in the capital city and sort of the epicenter of a lot of East metropolitan area activities, and also recognizing the historic relationship between the City of St. Paul and the 4th District, passed a resolution requesting the legislature and the governor to formulate minimum change redistricting plan that allows for St. Paul and Minneapolis to continue to be in separate congressional districts. They also go on to call on Mayor Norm Coleman, who in an earlier position had opposed a federal move to have St. Paul included in the Minneapolis Metropolitan Reporting District, obviously very concerned that the uniqueness that distinguishes St. Paul continue to be recognized at the federal level. They call on Mayor Norm Coleman to join them in this request to the legislature, and I'm going to contact our mayor and see if, in fact, he'll do that. The Ramsey County Board of Commissioners also pretty much expressed similar concern, recognizing that the Ramsey County desires to continue to be represented in Congress with the county boundaries entirely in the 4th Congressional District. So we heard earlier from some local elected officials. We didn't ask all of them what their party affiliation were, but the ones that we did told us that they were Republicans. And so I just wanted, for the record, at least for today, to enter some other local elected officials' desires in regards to this issue. The majority of the City Council of St. Paul, for the record, and of Ramsey County are DFLers, but they're local elected officials like the other individuals here this morning, and their request would be to not combine St. Paul and Minneapolis in one congressional district.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a
question? Thank you, Representative Mariani. And I think the City of Woodbury, for members, have a handout as well for the record saying the City of Woodbury supports the bill and increasing the opportunity for minorities to elect a candidate of their choice as required by the VRA. The proposal also unites suburban communities, which I think we heard from some of the other first-ring suburbs today in terms of some similar issues, transportation, taxation, education, housing, human service needs. It's signed from the mayor, William Hargis. I have no idea what the mayor's political affiliation is. I'm sorry, Representative Seifert.
Mr. Chair, the handout I have from the Ramsey County Board says draft, and there's no names or roll call on there. Is this something that they are going to vote on, or something that they have adopted unanimously or otherwise?
Representative Mariani, are you aware?
Mr. Chair, I was
notified. Has a different makeup, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was notified just yesterday afternoon that they had passed this, and so I think what they had before them was just the draft and had not mocked up, but I would certainly enter into the record at a future date their final vote on this.
Okay. So there was not a final vote?
Mr. Chair, I was told yesterday that, in fact, there was a final vote and that this passed. I asked them to fax over the resolution. It could very well be that they either had not mocked up the final vote or they just sent me the resolution as it was before the county board, but I will get the final vote before the committee.
Any further questions? Representative Gray.
Was it something I said, Mr. Chairman?
No.
I know we're all in a hurry to get out of here, and frankly, I'd like to get out of here and get something to eat as well. Just want to ask one final question, Representative Seifert, again, with regard to this issue of communities of interest. And, you know, I talked about some of the diversity in terms of representing a Minneapolis-St. Paul district, and I was looking at some of these others, and I just, would you agree that, generally speaking, all these, or at least certainly the 4th, the 5th, the 3rd, the 6th, that I see here on this map, all have significant competing interests? And by that I mean, here on the 6th, you've got North Oaks, you've also got inner ring suburb like Brooklyn Center. You've got in the 4th, I used to work out in Invergrove Heights in West St. Paul, and that's competing with Forest Lake or Lakeville or Empire. Very different areas with different interests. Would you not acknowledge that all these at least have those competing interests? And even though we talk about communities of interest, that anyone representing any one of these districts is going to have to grapple with the competing interests of that particular district.
Representative Seifert.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm a positive type of guy, and so I hate to highlight negative things about any of our communities. You know, my legislative district, we've got towns, my mother-in-law said back in the 40s, the girls used to attack each other and pull each other's hair in the 40s at basketball games because the visceral competition in these basketball tournaments and so forth. And, you know, I understand that there are competing interests anywhere you go, but I think when you look at the principles that we have to live with in finding communities of interest, the bottom line question that you have to look at when you look at any map that's presented, and I just want to remind everybody, this is the only map for 3 weeks that we've had to look at, that we've had to scrutinize, that folks have been able to run numbers on, and Representative Mariani had numbers, I have numbers, you have numbers. Where are the other plans? I'd love it. The map we have now is obsolete, so to talk about that is like talking about a flat tire and driving to California. You just can't do it. The map now is obsolete. I will admit that there are competing interests in any given map. So the challenge is to find those particular areas that have the most in common and uniting those areas and bringing that commonality together so they have one united voice in Congress fighting for that interest, fighting for urban development, fighting for transit, fighting for the immigration issues, fighting for those social service issues, and not having divided interests that maybe I have to do, maybe I have to vote this way and take away from this area of my district. If you can find those commonalities, you can give that congressman that one united fighting voice for that district. So there are competing interests, and Representative Gray, you are correct when there are competing interests anywhere, but I think our challenge as a redistricting committee is in serving the best interests of the state of Minnesota. Let's find those common areas of interest, reflecting the changes of the last 10 years that have happened in population, which is obvious suburban growth, and uniting those suburban voices that we heard from this morning, those mayors, those city councilmen, those residents, and at the same time enhancing communities that Mr. Taylor talked about, in giving those folks more of a voice in the process. So what I would submit is there will be competing interests anywhere, but the challenge that we have is to unite those that have the most in common, and I think this map reflects that.
Mr. Chairman, one final question, Gray, and then I will leave this alone. Would you also acknowledge, too, that historic pairings have some significance in that, for instance, the fact that Minneapolis and St. Paul have been separate for an extended period of time, the fact that a particular district has been represented by a particular in Congress in a particular configuration, that over time those constituencies tend to develop some working relationship, at least in terms of the historic pairing that they've had. Does history not play some role or have some significance in this process?
Mr. Chairman, I was a history teacher, and I would say in the particular case of the last 10 years that it does not, because we have had some fundamental changes in the state of Minnesota, and that is rapid suburban growth, and we need to reflect those changes. We have bought time and bought time now the last 20 years as this rapid suburban development has happened. But buying time any longer, I realize change is hard for some folks, and that some congressmen might have to meet a few new constituents and represent those common areas of interest. But when you take a look at those communities of interest, Edina, Minneapolis, Frogtown of St. Paul, and North Oaks, I think Minneapolis has more in common with Frogtown St. Paul than Edina does with North Minneapolis and North Oaks has with Frogtown. So in my opinion, this probably is a change that should have happened some years ago. And you learn from history. And a wise man once said that you should study history. So people should study history, because if you don't, you're doomed to repeat it. And I don't think we should repeat history, because history, I think, is behind the times in these particular maps that may be trucked out at some point that separate Minneapolis-St. Paul again and do not recognize the changes that have happened the last 10 years. Quite frankly, these changes have been going on for 30, 40 years, and I think this legislature is going to have to struggle with the fact that at long last it's time to reflect those changes. So, you know, I don't think that we have to adhere to the historical context of things. I think Representative Mariani and I had a good discussion about the 4th District is competitive for people of both parties, assuming a good candidate, woman or otherwise. And so I don't see any overarching text of keeping the core of the old districts. And I guess I have a question. Is that part of our principles, Mr. Chairman?
Well, and maintaining history is not one of our principles, obviously, as well as maintaining the status quo would not be one of the principles.
Is that part of the Senate standards, Mr. Chairman?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Well, let's see.
Representative Mariani.
The ridicule notwithstanding, I think there are a lot of citizens who think that history and their historical relationships are, in fact, important. And, you know, Minneapolis-St. Paul have two chambers of commerce. They're very distinct bodies. Minneapolis has long been the financial muscle in the center of the upper Midwest. St. Paul has kind of been relegated, if you will, to be more a government center. Our chambers of commerce have tend to reflect it, those kind of sociological, historical. Downtown St. Paul is kind of this quiet little downtown, although Norm is, you know, waking us up nowadays, and that's good. Whereas downtown Minneapolis has always kind of been this very fast-paced, very active community. St. Paul is basically, you know, your Catholic religious center of at least the Twin Cities area, whereas Minneapolis has tended to be your Protestant center. Minneapolis, geographically, topographically, were the beginnings of the plains, and St. Paul, the ends of the world. I mean, we can go on and on and on with these things, and, you know, we can ridicule them and make light of them, but they are, in fact, important to people. And I'm a student of history, too, Representative Seifert, and I, in fact, majored in history in college. And one of the things that history has taught me is that when you isolate and segregate people from one another, that's when you have problems. I have a pretty diverse district. I have downtown St. Paul. I have the West Side, which is the old sort of Ellis Island of St. Paul. The West 7th community, which is currently, unfortunately, the home of the stinkiest ethanol plant in Minnesota right now. And at one time, I used to have Crocus Hill, which, you know, was sort of our Cadillac, you know, limousine liberals, you know, type. And I really rejoice in that diversity. I think that all those individuals, what they do to me, for me as a representative, is that they keep me balanced and they keep me in check. And I, you know, I think there are a lot of people out there who are really going to reject the notion that with all the issues that and the problems that the urban core has, you know, race issues and pollution issues and transportation issues and congestion issues, that somehow The only people who should really work on those issues are people who are relegated to only representing that community. I think it's refreshing that someone who also has to represent suburban communities who might have slightly different issues with that, depending how far out you go out in the core. And by the way, you know, I don't think the differences between Inner Ring and Minneapolis and St. Paul are as great as some people are professing that they are. And it's too bad that we didn't, knowing that this was coming, we didn't spend more than just the morning's discussion trying to delineate the differences between Inner Ring suburban communities and the urban core. That would have been an exciting discussion, Mr. Chair, if we had done that during the course of the last several months, to have a really exciting discussion among suburbanites and urban people, and let's talk about our differences and our commonality. But we didn't have that. We had a morning's discussion with a handful of people doing that. But my point is that for the sake of our society, it seems to me the best representation is a representation is to have elected officials who have a diverse electorate. Because that way you have to walk in many people's shoes and not just worry about, you know, your very parochial issues. And you've been here long enough, I believe, Representative Seifert, to see some of the damage that happens when folks can only see their own community's interests and don't see other, you know, other community interests out there. So, you know, to me, that's one of the, kind of the biggest objections that I have to this, that I think it really does relegate Minneapolis-St. Paul in terms of its voice in Washington, D.C. under this plan to an isolated situation, an isolated position. And my experience as an elected official for the past 11 years and as a historian, if you will, tells me that a diverse electorate will create the kind of balances and the balance and perspective that's necessary for good, sound public policy. So obviously we differ in that, but please don't make light of you know, our state's history and our traditions in regards to this issue. I think, in fact, they are quite important, whether or not they show up in the principles that are going to be adopted, that have been adopted by either the House and the Senate.
Well, Representative Mariani, I mean, I can certainly speak for myself, and I respect your viewpoint in terms of respecting diversity and it not being in the principles. I think Representative Seifert's making the case, as we heard from some others this morning, is that there are similarities as well among the communities. I mean, the United Way, having joined Minneapolis-St. Paul together. And on the isolation argument, and some might argue that Minneapolis and St. Paul have been isolated apart from each other for the last 10, 20, 30 years because of the way the district has been drawn as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, to close, Representative Mariani, I guess I consider myself but a lowly tadpole in the big pond of the Minnesota legislature, so I haven't been here forever, but I'm a quick learner, perhaps. And I used to teach Minnesota government law and history, and that maybe is why one of the reasons I'm on this committee, but setting the principles aside and saying we need to maximize the diversity of representation by geography, you know, we could start at the Capitol building and draw precinct by precinct line up to Grand Marais, and then we could take another one and draw precinct by precinct line up to Roseau, and we could take another one and draw precinct by precinct line up to Wheaton. And, you know, at some point we need to recognize the changes that have happened in the state demographically and following the principles that are laid out in the law. And when you take a look at this map, I think that those principles were followed in a very commendable manner. Change is hard, change is not easy, but change is sometimes needed. I think we've all agreed that we have to disagree at some point, and I'm looking very forward to seeing an alternative plan at some point. The clock is ticking, and I hope folks in the legislature and both bodies will, at some point, this bill's been on the table for quite some time, rather than saying how bad this plan is in some ways, bring out an alternative and point out why that is better in following the principles of redistricting, fewer splits, recognizing the changes that have happened the last 10 years. All those commonalities that we talked about earlier, and in following the testimony that we also heard earlier, that the House so kindly went out to rural Minnesota, in which the Senate did not, and having three field hearings in rural Minnesota, having four rural districts and four non-rural districts, and following all of the testimony, the best that we could, following the principles, following the changes of demographics, I think this map is commendable. I didn't sit down with a slide rule and work it all out overnight. But Senator Kleist put a lot of work into this, and I think when you look at those principles and those changes that have happened, this map is really something on the table that deserves serious consideration for passage. And I don't believe we're taking a vote tonight, Mr. Chair, so where there'd be more people in the room, but that's my closing comments.
Thank you, Representative Seifert, and thank you, members. With that, the chair will lay over House File 2505. And I appreciate you coming back today after session very much. So, Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I know Representative Gray asked this question this morning. I'm wondering, after a whole day, whether there's new information. Do you have a, sort of an end date here and when you expect us to vote on this plan?
Representative Mariani, as I mentioned earlier, I expect we'll probably have a committee hearing next either Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday in terms of passing a legislative plan and a congressional plan to the floor.
Both a legislative plan and a congressional
correct.
Plan. Is that correct? Right. Mr. Chair, I would I would urge you and ask you to, because we haven't talked about a legislative plan, and you know we're 10 days away from the end of session, so I guess I would just request that the sooner we get to that, the better, because that's going to be a much more complicated animal, I suspect, than just trying to divide the state into eight parts.
Yeah, as soon as we can do that, as well as I'm sure the plan Representative Pawlowski has been talking about, as soon as he's available to do that, I mean, it takes a while to crunch numbers, and I mean, we're moving well ahead of the Senate. I know they're going to be under the crunch time as well, in terms of we've had many more hearings. We're going earlier. That's right. Representative Gray.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to the legislative plan, are you planning again on having a hearing on that plan similar to what we did today on the congressional plan, or will you just present the plan, both of them together, for a vote on the same day?
Hey, Representative Gray, I expect that we'll take up a legislative plan as well as a congressional plan, vote them either as together in one bill or send them separately. So I expect that, from your side of the aisle, you'll have a proposal either as amendments, delete alls, whatever, legislative and congressional as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me understand this. Will we have a separate day with a hearing on the legislative plan and then a vote after that, or are you planning on having just one hearing at which point we would vote on both plans? Are there going to be 2 days, two hearings, or a hearing and a vote? Or are they all going to be combined?
Representative Gray, right now I expect we'll just have one hearing.
One hearing.
Right, and vote on both plans that day. That may change, but that's the plan right now, given the time constraints of where we're at.
Mr. Chairman, are you also anticipating then having testimony at that hearing on the legislative plan similar to what we did today?
Testimony is always open to the public.
Then will we have advance notice, significant advance notice, and I know that could be difficult if you're saying Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. I mean, for instance, if you decide on the weekend it's Monday, it would be difficult to arrange to have folks who might be interested in testifying to be here.
Well, Representative Gray, I mean, I've given Representative Pawlowski my word that I'll let him know as soon as possible when we actually schedule the hearing. Obviously, if we're going to have the hearing on Monday, we'd have to, fulfill the 24-hour notice rule in terms of you'd know on Friday, you wouldn't know on the weekend.
Okay.
So I expect that we need to be flexible with the time frames as much as possible.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not suggesting that you're trying to pull anything. I mean, I think in the past you've certainly responded to my concerns or my questions about the time frame and what was going to happen at the hearings. And I was just trying again to get a perception on what's going to happen next week, how much time we might have to react to that. So I was not trying to suggest that that you were trying to pull something over on us.
I'd like to give all members as much notice as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, committee's adjourned.
Oh, I got mine. I've got it. Oh, wait, no, I didn't take the big map.